I'm here at the Adelaide at the 2012 Writers' Week, which actually officially starts tomorrow. But I've snuck in a little bit early to speak to American writer Ron Rash. Ron, welcome to Adelaide.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Terrific. And you've had a good sleep, I believe, so you're ready to go.
I did. I'm ready to go, yeah.
Good.
I had about 11 straight hours. That's
great.
What I needed.
Quite a few sessions coming up over the next few days. Now, I wanted to speak particularly today about your most recent novel, The Cove, but also probably touch on some of your other writing. So I might just introduce you for our listeners. Ron Rash is a multi-award winning poet, short story writer and novelist, and his novel Serena was on the New York Times bestseller list and also a finalist in the Penn Faulkner list. Burning Bright, which is a collection of short stories, I think won the 2010 Frank O'Connor Award. And you actually live in the Appalachian Mountains and you're teaching at West Carolina University, I understand.
All true
so far, so good. Yeah. Now, I wanted to speak about The Cove, but it appears to me that The Cove, like much of your other writing, is very multi-layered, that there are lots of different themes that you're dealing with at the same time. And one of the themes, I suppose, in The Cove that interested me particularly, and it's picked up, I think, in One Foot in Eden too, is that sort of theme of hiddenness. You use what seems to me like a metaphor of the dam coming in, covering what's been there before, but it seems like what's been there before often has an effect on current situation. Is that sort of a fair summation of
I think it is. And William Faulkner, also a Southern writer, once said that the past is not dead, it's not even past. And I think my work tends to show that and emphasize that. Yes,
yeah.
Very much so.
It's almost like it's something to do, too, with your take on history, perhaps, that there seems to be a very thin wall between the past and the present, that the two are sort of often merging together.
I believe so, and particularly in that region, and perhaps because my family has very deep roots in the Appalachians. So both my mother's and my father's families have lived there over 200 years, which, you know, the United States is like Australia, a relatively young culture as far as Europeans. And so that's for a family to have lived there that long is pretty unusual in
Indeed.
The United States.
Yes, And is there a special sort of history to the Appalachians in that I read somewhere that for much of the American history, the Appalachians were a big barrier to Western expansion. So was it an area that was sort of perhaps a bit untouched for a long time and developed its own particular culture?
Very much so. It's an area that even today is very rural. It's an area that has been a tough area to live in economically for most of its time. It's because of the mountains. It's hard to. I mean, there were never plantations in the Appalachians, and most of the farming was done very small scale.
Yes, yeah. So that landscape, which is a big part of your story, seems to bear the scars or memories even of atrocities. I mean, even there's hints of the Confederate War, the atrocities sort of that caused. A sort of superstitions too. There's things in the land that also are affecting the characters currently too. Is that a fair thing to say in The Cove?
I think so. For me, landscape is always a character in my work, but also I tend to think, and I've never really articulated this as well as I'd like to, but that landscape is destiny sometimes. I would like, in my work, I find that sometimes the landscape itself seems to shape the fate of the characters. And I think that's one reason I feel a real kinship to Australian writers. When I read Patrick White's Voss, I had the same sense.
So in the case of The Cove and perhaps One Foot in Eden, how does the landscape shape those particular characters?
I think in both it shapes their fates. I think particularly even more so in The Cove, it's I think more obvious in the sense that the landscape's bleakness, its lack of light, sense of being away from everything shapes Laurel's life. It impacts the way she views the world, and also the possibilities of her life.
Yes, yes. And I suppose what you're saying, sort of that link with Australian writing with Patrick White too, is there sort of an echo with the Australian experience? I know we're sort of reflecting very much at the moment on how the landscape bears the scars of past atrocities to the original inhabitants too. Is that sort of something that would find echo in your work as well?
Definitely, and back going back to the Civil War, but even beyond that, back to what happened with the Cherokee and the displacement of the Cherokee, and of course the Cherokee's displacement of earlier tribes. So there's this landscape that has layers of atrocity.
Yes, yes. Something particularly that I noticed in both The Cove and also One Foot in Eden, you deal very much with men wounded by war in One Foot in Eden. It's post-war, the 1950s, so post-Second World War. And in The Cove, it's, I think, set in 1918, so just in the last part of World War One. The characters in The Cove, they're sort of wounded or they're outsiders. Hank has one arm, Laurel is lonely, feels rejected, she's got a birthmark and she's regarded as a witch. Mm-hmm. And Walter, the German, supposedly is dumb, but he's, as a German, he's an outsider. All these characters, why do they appeal? They're very much wounded or outside people.
Yeah. Well, I think those kinds of characters are always more interesting to me because there's an inevitable conflict, and conflict is so often what sparks a novel, makes a novel interesting. Mm. But also, I think the idea of the wounded in some ways actually ties back to a reality as far as the wars, because the Appalachians have always given an inordinate number of soldiers to America's wars. The region, and part of that's because sometimes it was, particularly like in the Gulf War and the Iraq War, there's been this, because a lot of Appalachia's impoverished, that's the only outlet for these young people is to go into war.
Yes, that always seems to be the story, doesn't it, the war? I mean, it's the poor people who usually go, because it is a matter of economy, really.
Right, and that's one thing I hope that when readers read The Cove that they'll recognize that I'm writing as much about today.
I wanted to ask you that.
Yes.
Yes.
Because it, you know, as the character Chauncey Fife in the novel represents to me a certain group of, it's interesting to me that it's always the politicians and the people whose children are not going to these wars that seem to be most adamant about having them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Chauncey represents probably the worst of that sort of nationalistic, that jingoism, doesn't he? That is something that you're still reflecting on now?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And what's happening today in America. Yeah. And also, just as I say, I think the fact that because we have a volunteer army, not a draft, the people who can be most fervent about writing have no concerns about whether it will affect them.
No. So I wonder if you could say a bit more about that sort of, you're using sort of coded language to speak about sort of contemporary situations. I mean, the novel The Cove is about intolerance, it's about misguided nationalism, I would think. Are you saying something about contemporary politics, saying something about making a social commentary about contemporary politics? Is that your
think so. And I think, though, I think in a sense, it's almost, I would also say that it so often has been this case that people very often have the worst instincts sometimes prevail in situations like this. But but I think as far as contemporary, just that it seems to me that people who very often want these wars are the people who have the least stake in them as far as lives. There's no chance they or their children will go over there.
Yes, yeah. It seemed to me too that perhaps another theme that's very common to your work too is that sort of struggle between, I suppose, environmentalists and developers. I mean, it's very much true in Serena, that the character of Serena sort of represents that worst of the money-grabbing, developing people. But even in, I think, One Foot in Eden too, there's that sort of, the developers are coming in, the dam's going to cover over the characters where they've lived, but also a theme perhaps in The Cove too, that struggle between the two. Is that also a contemporary statement?
It is, and I think it certainly, that very often in such situations, when there are dams made like this all over the world, it's very often in areas that where the people have the least power. And so that's something I'm writing about. But also what I found particularly interesting and sad and tragic in Serena is that you're in the actual people in the community, many of whom are loggers, to survive the depression, to serve, to save their families, to give their families food, they have to actually destroy their own world.
Yes. And that's probably still a contemporary thing too, isn't it? I mean, the people who, and I'm thinking in Tasmania, people, the loggers in Tasmania, I mean, they don't want to give up the jobs because, you know, they depend on it economically. Right. So there's always that bind between, you know, preserving the environment, but, you know, people struggling for existence.
Right, and it's, you know, it's much easier for someone such as myself to be pro-environmental when I'm not who has three kids at home and all my skills are as a logger. Or in the United States, also a coal miner, same thing happening with coal.
Just moving on to something a little bit different, the thing that struck me about particularly The Cove, but also your other novels and short stories, that sort of authenticity of time and place and the vernacular, the way that people speak. It seemed to me sort of particular to the period, certainly. Is that something that you had to do by research, or is that something you have a feel for?
I was very lucky in that when I was growing up, I spent a lot of time with my older relatives. I'd actually stay on a farm with my grandmother. And so I got to hear that Appalachian speech. I got to hear the stories of the region. I do a good amount of the research, but as far as the vernacular, a lot of that I was fortunate enough to hear from my older relatives.
Now, wondering what the catalyst was for the Cove. Was it those historical facts around the Vaterland and the Hot Springs Camp that appeared in the 1916 New York Times? Was that the jumping off point for that?
It was. I mean, it was such an incredible story, and I had not heard that story till about 5 years ago, and very few people in the United States know that there were German internment camps. You know, everyone knows about the Japanese internment camps, but during World War I, there were German internment camps. One was in the North Carolina mountains, and I just thought that what a fascinating story. You've got these German, some of them were orchestra members who were in this on this luxury liner. They're not in the war, but then suddenly they're shipped into the North Carolina mountains.
Now, a label that's sometimes put to your work is Southern Gothic. Is that something that you're comfortable with?
In the sense that I see myself, I would like to think that my work is, I'm not saying it's the quality, but certainly I would hope that it, in a sense, has the atmosphere that one might see in William Faulkner or Cormac McCarthy. I certainly see myself in that lineage.
Yes. Now, I can't let you go without saying having you say something about your short stories. The first book of yours I picked up was Burning Bright, and I just thought they were just such a wonderful collection of short stories. There are echoes in here of some of the themes of novels, particularly things like the man falling into the well, the water covering, belief in the power of nature. But obviously it's a different process. How do you know when you're starting a story whether it's going to be a short story or a novel?
Or a poem. I write poetry as well. And I actually don't know. I sometimes think what might be a poem ends up being a short story. Sometimes what seems to be a short story ends up a novel. It just depends. But I do find short stories the most challenging form.
Why is that?
I think a really good short story can give the reader the satisfaction, at least to a degree, of a novel, a sense of a story being told completely. And yet at the same time, it has very often the concision of language that one looks for in poetry.
So is it? So when do you know whether you've written a good short story or not?
Very often it's when my brother tells me. My brother is my best reader, and I usually have a pretty good sense of it. But he's like, as siblings tend to be, he has no pity, so he lets me know if it's not working.
Oh, you're very fortunate then, because sometimes family members, you know, say all the right
things. Right. Well, my brother does not, so he's a good editor, so that helps a lot.
Indeed. Yeah. I find the short story one of the most challenging things to write. Well, it's a bit like. There has to be a lot of stuff sort of hidden underneath, the stuff that you see on the top. But unless you go away sort of feeling that, that sort of thought that there's more there, unless it lingers, to me, it's not a good short story.
I think that's the key. I think when we come away from a really good short story, we have the sense that we've seen all that this character will be and will be in a single moment, or a single, maybe few moments. And that's, writers such as William Trevor can do this so magnificently.
Yes, it's a hard thing to achieve.
It is.
Well, Ron, thank you very much for spending the time with us, and we do hope that you enjoy your time in Adelaide, and look forward to reading more of your work.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your interest.